In the post-9/11 world, the U.S. is willing to invade a country on the grounds that it may be cultivating nuclear weapons. But how does our government gather intelligence about weapons of mass destruction? On today's Afternoon Magazine, I'm speaking with a scholar who's investigated American nuclear intelligence from Nazi Germany to Iran and North Korea. I'm Bill Hammack. Join the conversation today by calling 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. So let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, Jeffrey Richelson.
Thank you.
Jeff, your subtitle, American Nuclear Intelligence, you know, brings to mind the failure of our intelligence in Iraq. In fact, your book, Spying on the Bomb, is in essence a set of case studies showing how difficult it is to gather nuclear intelligence and even highlighting the debates with the intelligence community about Iraq were not at all unique. So let's start by focusing on other times that the U.S. relied on intelligence to guide foreign policy. For example, in the 1960s, JFK explored how to rein in and perhaps take out China's nuclear program. So tell me a little bit about how well our intelligence detected China's nascent nuclear efforts. You know, what were the successes and what were the failures?
Well, it was certainly a very mixed record. On the positive side, we had developed a whole variety of techniques for detecting the building of nuclear facilities. We had satellite reconnaissance at that time. We had U-2 aircraft. We had other means of detecting this type of activity. And the U.S. was pretty good in terms of identifying what facilities were related to the Chinese nuclear program. We identified eventually Lop Nor as a test site. We identified a whole series of facilities in central China, at Baotou and Shao, a variety of other places, as being part of the nuclear program. But at the same time, the U.S. CIA and other agencies did not do a very good job of specifying or determining exactly what role those facilities played. And in the early 60s to mid-60s, they were often wrong about whether a facility was involved in producing enriched uranium or whether it was doing something else, such as developing uranium hexafluoride or being involved in plutonium production. So they were often wrong about what some of those specific facilities were doing. And the thing they were certainly wrong about was whether the Chinese would be trying to develop a plutonium-based bomb or an enriched uranium-based bomb. And it turned out to be the latter, despite the fact that the intelligence estimates were all premised on the basis that they would go the plutonium route, because that seemed to be the easiest one.
So Kennedy, at least according to McGeorge Bundy, was seriously thinking of some action against the Chinese at one point. How did the intelligence play into that decision, the decision not to go ahead, for example?
Well, a key factor, and certainly not the only factor, but certainly a contributing factor, was that the intelligence was simply imprecise. We didn't know often, as I said, exactly, we didn't know what all the facilities might be. There might be things out there we didn't know about. We didn't know, in some cases, whether things were operational or not operational. We couldn't assess exactly what impact an attack would have in the long term on the Chinese program, because we didn't understand so much about it. So in that case, the sort of uncertainty provided a break on action. And not that it would have happened anyway, but certainly it was something that in the category of maybe we shouldn't do this, it was on that side.
And so the Kennedy administration actually used that uncertainty to make a decision not to go ahead? The uncertainty was the key here?
No, I wouldn't say it was the key. There were a whole series of factors. I mean, we tried to enlist the Russians at one point in a joint operation against the Chinese, and that didn't go anywhere. So it was just, it's hard to say that it was the deciding factor. It was a factor that mitigated against an attack. The fact that we couldn't really assess exactly what the consequences consequences would be.
So now in discussing China, you mentioned some of the ways satellite and U-2 that we could detect the nuclear weaponry or nuclear facilities. Can you give me a sense of the full set of methods that the U.S. uses today to detect nuclear activity?
Sure. It essentially falls into two categories of nuclear activity we're talking about. One is the construction of facilities and their operation, and then there's the nuclear testing portion. With regard to the construction and operation of facilities, we have a whole variety of satellites that can produce images of those facilities in great detail. We have satellites that can intercept conversations that may be relevant to what's going on at those facilities. We have means of detecting krypton 85 emissions, which are related to the production of plutonium. That's not from satellite, but from ground-based sensors.
How close do those ground-based sensors need to be?
Well, reportedly, the Russians had sensors in North Korea that they had installed in their embassy at our behest. Mm-hmm. I think you have to be fairly close if you want to be sure that you're getting the krypton 85 from a particular facility, because this originated in the early days of the Cold War, where what the U.S. and Britain did was measure the amount of krypton 85 in the atmosphere and were able to figure out, and with that baseline and knowing how much they contributed from their plutonium production every year, could then calculate the entire amount in the atmosphere and then figure that the difference was what the Russians were producing. Mm-hmm. And therefore, they were able to estimate, although it necessarily wasn't a great estimate, of plutonium production and the number of plutonium warheads. So this depended on sort of a worldwide survey. If you want to be able to localize it, then you have to be much closer. I don't know exactly how many miles, but the fact that we were relying on the Russians to put sensors in their embassy in Korea implies that it has to be reasonably close.
When you say Korea, you mean North Korea?
North Korea.
Yeah. So we have satellites. They take images. How are they able to tell that a particular building is for a nuclear facility and just a building? I mean,
usually it's because they have distinctive characteristics that you, whether you see it at ground level or from a satellite above.
Can you give us an example of one of those characteristics?
Well, I mean, if you look at the cooling towers, mm-hmm, of a nuclear facility, it looks very distinct. I mean, if you've ever seen a picture of them, certainly when you look at them from above, even from above, it seems clear. Other ways that they do it is they learn what's distinctive about, say, a nuclear type of facility. Say certainly a reactor is easy to spot from the air. I mean, it has you can just look at it and you know, mm-hmm, that it's a reactor. Other things they would say, look at what the U.S. has done in that area and how it looks like from above. If you took a satellite picture of a U.S. nuclear facility, say a uranium enrichment facility, and then they would use that as a benchmark to compare it with facilities in other countries that would have those distinctive characteristics. There are documents produced by these agencies known as photo interpretation keys or imagery interpretation keys, where they've give a photo interpreter an idea of what something looks like from above by having, say, photographed our own or other countries' facilities that we're sure of, and then comparing that.
So you've mentioned technical things, the satellites, the sensors. Do we also use human assets?
We certainly try. I mean, we've had sort of mixed success depending on the country we're dealing with. We were never able to, as far as I can tell, say, penetrate the South African nuclear program with a human source. On the other hand, with regard to Taiwan's program, we did have a key source in there in the 70s and 80s who helped us understand what Taiwan was really doing And that was a case that actually led to action on the part of the U.S. in terms of diplomatic action that forestalled the Taiwanese program.
So most of the things we've talked about have been covert. Do we ever make use of what might call open source material?
Certainly.
Maybe we should define what we mean by that.
Open source material is material that is, say, published in a foreign country, whether by the government or by the press, that there's no, it does not constitute espionage to acquire.
A newspaper, a scientific journal, or those?
Newspaper, scientific journal, some sort of manual, a book. And we've certainly for years done that in terms of, I mean, if you go back to the Cold War in the Soviet Union, there was a CIA analyst who mapped out the whole sort of electric power network, part of the Soviet Union, that allowed an estimation of how much power was going to nuclear facilities and therefore how much uranium could be produced. And in that case, all the basis for his analysis were photos in a Soviet magazine as well as some obscure Soviet publications that you certainly wouldn't see in a ordinary bookstore, but something that a specialist would know to acquire.
Mm-hmm.
We've also, people, you know, certainly have been reading the press in any country that has a prospective nuke for anything that government officials might say relevant to the program or some obscure technical article that's relevant. If you go back to World War II, the first sort of U.S. nuclear intelligence efforts were some well-known physicists like the late Philip Morrison gathering up what was published in German scientific journals and looking in that for clues as to what German capability was in the nuclear weapons area and what they might actually be doing.
So we have all of this technology, which is just amazing. We use human reporting, as you said, from covert and from open sources. So is it then straightforward to determine precisely what kind, if any, nuclear materials exist?
No. Let me just mention first that in terms of technical sources, there's also the technical sources that are involved in actually detecting nuclear tests and measuring and estimating exactly the details of those tests, and those involve satellites that detect the light flash from a nuclear explosion,
mm-hmm.
Seismic sensors that can detect the shock wave, seismic signal, aircraft that can detect nuclear debris, and all that goes into assessing the yield of the test, its strength, as well as the composition of the nuclear material. But to get back to the question of straightforward, it's certainly not straightforward, particularly when you're trying to assess not details about a test that's taken place, but whether a test is upcoming or exactly what the other country is doing, because they usually will be trying to hide what they're doing, at least to a certain extent. Something like uranium enrichment is not as easy to detect as plutonium production, certainly because you don't need a reactor for that. And what you're trying to do is take bits of data and fit it together. So you may be measuring the size of a particular facility and looking at the power that's going into it and then trying to estimate what's coming out. But it's certainly not it's part art and it's part science.
I'm talking with Jeffrey Richardson, author of Spying on the Bomb, American Nuclear Intelligence from Nazi Germany to Iran and North Korea. Join the conversation by calling 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. So I want to picture this process because it's central to your book, that we gather all this information. And the result is frequently ambiguous. You have to use educated guesswork to take over. Can you give me some examples from you know, historical examples where there was a specific issue in China or the Soviet Union or even assessing Nazi Germany where the experts disagreed?
Certainly. In Nazi Germany, there was the question of how far have they gotten with the program, because that was certainly the time we were at the very beginning in terms of primitive nature of our nuclear intelligence efforts. And there were some who suspected that the Germans were running essentially a deception program, that they were much farther along than the evidence might lead one to believe. On the other hand, there were the British in particular who were involved in this controversy, who were much more sanguine about how far the Germans had gotten, and they turned out to be right. If you go back to not the present Gulf War, but the previous Gulf War in 1991, there was a dispute in the intelligence community as to how far the Iraqis had gotten. And the CIA certainly underestimated how extensive the Iraqi nuclear program was. They really weren't aware that the Iraqis were really trying every possible method to produce fissile material for a bomb. And there were people in the Department of Energy who disagreed, who were more concerned as to how far the Iraqis had gotten. And this time around, the roles in some ways reversed, where you had the CIA and some other agencies believing that Iraq was much farther along in terms of its whole weapons of mass destruction program than some of the experts in the Department of Energy and Bureau of Intelligence and Research believed them to be.
So every one of your case studies, as I'm calling them, you know, it's a very sobering reminder of how often the professionals in this nuclear intelligence business have been at least a little wrong in a field where being a little bit wrong can have catastrophic consequences. So in such an environment, it's neither technical resources nor cleverness that can substitute for sound political judgment. So tell me a little bit about the relationship between policymakers and the intelligence community. I mean, what needs to change or needs to happen there?
Well, I think the intelligence community certainly needs to be very clear about how it comes to its conclusions, because just the overall judgments may conceal the degree of uncertainty that they are dealing with. And I think certainly that was the case with the most recent Iraq estimates, where the conclusions were based on based on extrapolating what we knew in 1998 with where we assumed that the Iraqis would have gone from there, combining that with simply a lack of knowledge, which was interpreted, which fueled the interpretation that they must be up to something because of their denial and deception activities and where we knew they were in the past. So I think the intelligence community certainly needs to be very clear in dealing with policymakers that this may be our judgment, but it's based on all this host of uncertainties. And so it's our best guess, but it may be only a guess. I think, on the other hand, the policymakers need to probe also as to what's the basis of this judgment, what type of dissent is there in the intelligence community, what attempts have been made to have an exchange of views between dissenting views, and where has that taken us? Certainly, with regard to the aluminum tube issues, the aluminum tubes and the centrifuges in 2002-2003. There was a serious debate within the intelligence community, and I think largely because of the failure of the director of Central Intelligence, there wasn't the proper exchange of views, there weren't the proper meetings being held to try to work this out and see whose views were really the most convincing. So I think it goes both ways. The intelligence community needs to identify where it doesn't have adequate data and certainly try to get it, But in terms of at any given point issuing an estimate or conclusions for to political leaders, it needs to be very clear about what it really knows and what it really doesn't know, and what and how the extent to which its judgments are simply based on extrapolating data.
Well, you touched on, I think, the question that is certainly on the tip of everyone's tongue who's listening to this, and that is, what happened in Iraq? Why the failure to report correctly on WD's? Why did that occur in Iraq?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. The up through 1998, or most of 1998, you had inspectors on the ground who could go to facilities that the U.S. might identify as suspicious and see what was going on. Then, at the end of 1988, because of the lack of cooperation from the Iraqi government, they were gone. We didn't have much in the way of human sources, independent human sources run by the CIA. So basically, we were dependent on technical collection, meaning satellite coverage of facilities. And you could see, say, that a facility was being rebuilt, but you couldn't see what was going on within it. So with the lack of any on-the-ground data and limited to things like satellite coverage, the people were left to infer what might be going on. And that inference, the conclusions they drew, were heavily influenced by past Iraqi behavior, which meant both that they had made enormous efforts in earlier years to try to build a bomb, plus their denial and deception and uncooperative stance with regard to the inspectors, which were actions that seemed to be those of an organization or a country with something to hide. And then you add into that the fact, and I think this is something that made certainly Vice President Cheney very concerned, a past failure, the fact that they had underestimated the Iraqi program so bad in the late 1980s and early 1990s, that made them less willing to cast doubt on a strong Iraqi ongoing program.
So
they had been wrong in the past in that direction.
So if I understand this, really what we didn't have there was we were missing human intelligence. All we had were some defectors, but not really an internal human intelligence source. And the satellite photos are not that meaningful without a little bit of extra information. Is that a fair interpretation?
Well, it depends. It depends how. Sometimes you can see enough in the satellite photos to draw more accurate conclusions. But if you... In other cases, and this was a case, you have only sort of signs of activity, but not an ability to penetrate what's going on inside the building. And in that case, you would really need a human source. Now, we did apparently have one who did not say that there were no programs going on. This is reported in the recent report of the Senate Select Committee, a high-level source who did not tell us that there were no programs going on, probably because he didn't know that there were no programs going on.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes an oversimplification when it said, well, we simply need human intelligence. That's true, but we need the right type of human intelligence. And a lot of what we had in Iraq, particularly with defectors, was very bad human intelligence. And that's probably more harmful than having none at all.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly what you want in dealing with any foreign covert WMD program is you want your technical collection, your satellite imagery, your intercepts, whether from satellite or from the ground, but you also want human intelligence if you can get it. And sometimes you can't, and that simply limits what you can know for certain.
Well, when I read your chapter on Iraq, I was reminded of the opening to Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, which is all happy families are alike, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. And these failures, in intelligence and in politics, are just unique. There's all sorts of odd twists and turns, and it's not clear you can draw a general principle out of it. So I want to look a little more deeply at this failure in Iraq. And I should note that one thing I like about your book is you don't really have a political axe to grind. I find it a very reliable and very fair-minded guide. So when we look at this, this was not an intelligence failure. It was a political failure. It was a little bit of both. Can you nuance it a little bit for me?
Yeah, I think it certainly was in part an intelligence failure.
Mm-hmm.
Even if nothing more than in not being very clear about how the strength of their conclusions were based on sort of extrapolation and inference and looking at past Iraqi behavior. And I think when there's this scene recounted in Bob Woodward's book in which after the presentation about Iraqi WMD by the deputy director of Central Intelligence, President Bush says, "Is that all you've got?" And George Tenet says, "Don't worry, it's a slam dunk." And clearly, there wasn't evidence. The CIA didn't have, or the intelligence community didn't have enough data to really characterize it as a slam dunk. And I think Tenet did a real disservice by saying that. It certainly would give anybody being told that the impression that the data is really unequivocal mm-hmm. about what the Iraqis have and what the Iraqis are doing. And I think, you know, in my book I go into how George Tenet was really a cheerleader for the CIA, and he didn't really do his job as director of Central Intelligence in this case, which is to examine all the views of knowledgeable parts of the intelligence community and really ensure that the most reasonable, most expert opinions were the ones that percolated to the top. So I certainly think there was a failure on part of the intelligence community. I think the political failure was seizing on the WMD issue alone when there were broader issues involved. And Paul Wolfowitz, who was deputy Secretary of Defense, and in one interview a few years ago, noted that, well, the WMD issue was the one that everybody could agree on, and therefore that became the focus of the administration's case. And I think it's really important for political leaders, if they conclude that this is the only way we can deal with this threat, to specify all the reasons they think that's necessary, even if some of them would not convince other politicians or some other countries, is to specify what the entire set of reasons that they're taking this action is, and not sort of just latch on to what seems to be the easiest thing to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, I mean, what was really going on with the Bush administration is that they considered Iraq to be a long-term threat, particularly in the context of 9/11, and that whether they had a particular level of WMDs at this point in time, that the long-run prognosis was that they would proceed to build them and that eventually sanctions would go away and that they would resume these programs. And that, I think, would have been a much more accurate picture of their thinking than what they did, which was to latch on to the WMDs now sort of issue and sort of ride that as the one explanation. So I think you have failures on both parts.
Mm-hmm. So we have a caller from Champaign County. So caller on line one, please go ahead. I guess we don't have a caller. So I want to get a sense of the current state of nuclear weapons technology. In your book, you divide states into states that are signatories to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the NPT as it's called. You have the pariahs and the rogues. So who are the pariahs, and what kind of nuclear weapons do they have?
Well, I should say that I use the term pariahs in quotes because that was the way they were described back in the 70s. I wouldn't necessarily consider them all pariahs. It was Taiwan, Israel, and South Africa were characterized as pariahs back then. South Africa doesn't have nuclear weapons anymore. They had a covert program that led to the production of six fission bombs by the late 1980s, early 1990s, which they then destroyed after starting under the tenure of de Klerk. And that was a program in which the U.S. didn't know an awful lot about what was going on. There was a lot of uncertainty there. But in any case, they no longer have a program. Taiwan had a much more rudimentary program than the South Africans, and there were that was a clear case of a U.S. intelligence success where our having a human source led us to be very certain about what the Taiwanese were doing and not doing, and diplomatic pressure led them to halt their activities, which were at least headed towards the option of developing nuclear weapons. With regard to Israel, they have a fairly large nuclear arsenal, certainly not as large as the U.S. or Russia, but probably around 200 weapons. They first achieved a nuclear capability of some sort in the late 1960s, 1966, and since then have developed a much larger arsenal, which probably includes a neutron bomb as well as other type of bombs. So they have, of those three, they're the only one that really has a nuclear arsenal of any sort. The rogue states included...
Before we go to the rogue states, we had a technical glitch in our telephone system, but I believe it's working now. So we have a caller from Champaign.
Okay.
If the caller on line two would please go ahead.
Yes. You're talking about several other things right now, but I want to return to this issue of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're noting that George Tenet and others within the intelligence community made some severe mistakes. But something that bothers me about this particular administration, and I'm curious of your view on this, is that it seems to be well known that even prior to the administration starting, that there were several people at the top, Bush and those around him, who wanted to attack Iraq, who were very much contemplating this openly amongst each other, and that within a week of the beginning of the administration, they were already discussing the possibility. This is around January the 30th of 2001. And given that the British intelligence agencies, if I recall correctly, or at least the British government, that they had a memo in, I think, April 2002, saying that the American policymakers would fit the facts around the policy regarding Iraq. And then, of course, what I think was unprecedented, the vice president on two occasions going to Langley, is it, I think, the CIA
yes.
headquarters?
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to hear your view about that and the unprecedented character of those kinds of actions and their implications.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think with regard to their prior inclination to attack Iraq, certainly that goes to what I was talking about with regard to the whole set of issues that concern them with regard to Iraq and not simply whether there was the level of WMDs at that particular time. Whether they would have proceeded to do that had things played out differently in the UN and had Iraq responded differently is a question I guess we'll never know for sure. Certainly, there was if you go back to where we're talking about the Kennedy administration, there was an inclination on the part of some officials there to attack China and to dismantle its nuclear facilities, but ultimately they decided not to. And whether, if as I said, there had been different reaction from the Iraqi government, or if there had been more support for the U.S. position in the UN, whether things would have worked out differently, I don't know. It's certainly true that there was an inclination to act in this manner with regard to Iraq. Whether that policy would have changed had events taken place differently, it's hard to say. With regard to Cheney's visit, again, I think you have to go back to his experience as Secretary of Defense in the first Bush administration, where the CIA was very wrong about the extent of the Iraqi program, where the IAEA was wrong about that program, where they both underestimated what the Iraqis were up to. And that could certainly be something that made him skeptical about the quality of the, of their analysis, and make him want to press them as to what exactly the facts were and what they said. I guess the other thing I would add in that regard is that from all the investigations that have been done, analysts have never said that we felt any pressure to produce estimates that it accorded with the administration policy. And that's been in some of the Senate Select Committee reports. So I don't consider it to be necessarily something that's very sinister or really had any dramatic impact on what the intelligence estimates said.
I'm talking with Jeffrey Richardson, a senior fellow at the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. In his new book, Spying on the Bomb, he uses recently declassified material to uncover the secret history of American nuclear intelligence. You can join the conversation by calling 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. So a moment ago we mentioned the rogue states, which used to include Libya and Iraq, but probably now is only what Iran, Pakistan, North Korea. Do you have any assessment of the level of nuclear technology in North Korea?
Well, we know that they are capable of producing plutonium that can be used in a bomb, and it would appear capable of reprocessing it. Whether they have a uranium enrichment program is subject to speculation. Certainly, some of the data that the U.S. Collected indicated that they did. When we accused them of having it, at first they denied it, and then they acknowledged that they had such a program, and then they denied it again. So I think it's fair to say that we know that they're far enough along that they could have a small arsenal at this point. It's believed that they do have a small arsenal at this point, mm-hmm. At least of plutonium-based bombs.
Well, let's go ahead and take a couple more calls. We have, again, the caller from Champaign County. So the caller on line one, please go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't mean to start with this, but not seeing anything sinister in the machinations of Cheney and company after this time, I think, is more than a little Pollyannish. I'm not sure you're great on technical means, but he went down there more than twice. As far as testimony, the Senate phase one about this failure of intelligence was widely seen as a whitewash by ex-CIA people, even people who recently retired and worked under Bush II, like Drumheller or Paul Pillar, have said that the pressure was extremely intense, that the idea that there was no pressure to get the right results.
Oh, caller, let's pause there and go ahead and have a response. Jeff, you mentioned that you didn't feel the analysts had great pressure, and the caller is saying something different. Do you want to address that?
Well, with the example of Durmiller, there's an account in the most recent Senate Select Committee report that challenges his views. And I think
his views on what?
On the accuracy of some of his testimony, it was largely with regard to what a human source said in Iraq about the existence of WMD programs, and it contradicted exactly what Durmiller said that this source said. So I think you're going to get different views, but I don't have anybody telling me, for example, that there was pressure, until there's more data, I would at this point say that the case certainly isn't proven.
So, the caller, we do have another call, but you said
that
you had a second question. Would you like to go ahead with that?
I would. multilateralism, and I mean, technical means are fine, but and I think they're extremely important, but not looking at seriously what you can do with multilateral means with the IEA and a real commitment to the NPT, which this administration and others, actually, there was constantly money being spent on follow-on nuclear weapons. If we were more authentic in embracing a real commitment to denuclearize in stages, of course, we would be taken more seriously. But I don't think we are. Scott Ritter says that he was pulled out of
Caller,
Iraq.
Caller, do you have a specific question? You're making a statement here. Do you have a specific question, though, for our scholar today?
I don't think that would be very productive at this point. Let me at least make the statement about Scott Ritter.
I want to go ahead. We have just a few minutes left. And I want to go ahead and move to a caller two who's from Catlin. So caller two, please go ahead.
Yes, you were discussing rogue and pariah states, and I think that the role of Israel is the basis for much of our current difficulties throughout the world in the development of these weapons is largely unexamined. I would be particularly interested if you could provide additional information as to how Israel was enabled to secure some 12 metric tons of pure lithium-6, a restricted material, which is the fuel blanket for thermonuclear weapons.
Jeff, our callers always amaze me. There's a very specific question for you.
Right.
Do you have an answer to that?
I don't know what particular incident he's referring to.
So,
I know there was a plant in Pennsylvania that lost that. Some of the material there, a nuclear plant, some of the material there sort of, in a sense, disappeared, and whether it was due to it being siphoned off or whether it was a loss in the sort of production processes has been debated. There was a ship on the high seas that disappeared that, according to various accounts, was seized by the Mossad that had nuclear material. But I'm not sure what particular incident the call is referring to.
Well, in the minute or two that we have left, I wanted to touch on the sources for your book. Your book is really chock full of details about U.S. intelligence efforts, and I want to know, how did you get this information, and how arduous was it to get this?
Well, it was certainly very time-consuming, the fact that there's, I guess, 120 pages of notes at the back of the book sort of is a testament to that. It came partially from the Freedom of Information Act. A large number of requests submitted to the CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and other intelligence agencies. Some of it came from research in the National Archives, material that had been put on the shelves or on the computer systems there. A lot of it came from the accumulation of books and articles that I've gathered over the years and also in specific research for this book. And then some of it came from interviews with various intelligence and other officials, both from the U.S. and other countries.
And your group, the National Security Archive, is really, it's kind of a Freedom of Information activist group. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, that's part of it. Part of it is it gathers, goes out and tries to get declassified documents through the FOIA and other means, and publish them in sets of documents related to specific topics.
Jeff, this has been a very interesting hour here on Afternoon Magazine. Thanks for taking the time to chat today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Jeffrey Richardson, author of Spying on the Bomb, American Nuclear Intelligence from Nazi Germany to Iran and North Korea.